Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In New York Times columnist Nick Kristof's Africa, the dead and dying of Darfur in Sudan come powerfully to life, sometimes literally. In another urgent Kristof column this week from the landscape of rape and murder, a corpse literally opens its eyes, not yet dead, it turns out, as if to stare at the world. Some 300,000 have been killed in Darfur. Millions have been driven from their homes into desolation. The United States called it genocide in 2004, and now Kristof says it's getting worse, spilling into neighboring Chad. Up next on Point, voices from Darfur, the top Bush administration official on the case, and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times on the trail of genocide. Joining me now from New York is Nicholas Kristof. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times, just back this time from Chad, where the Darfur killing is now spreading. Nick Kristof, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
I'm delighted to be on, Tom.
Nick, you're using every trick, and I don't mean that lightly, in the book here to get people's attention. You've got corpses opening their eyes. You've got villages warning that they're going to be killed any minute. People describing the worst kind of death and depredation here. And still, the big intervention is not there. Why not? What's your understanding of why more hasn't been done?
I think there are a few reasons. I mean, I think that in many ways we've been distracted by Iraq, and that's true of both the administration and of those of us in the media, for example. I think there's also a sense among a lot of people that Africa is, you know, that it's sad what is happening there, but that Africa is always a mess and that, you know, we have our own problems. We don't need to get involved over there. And also, I think that there is a concern, unfounded, I believe, that doing more about Darfur would mean sending U.S. troops there. And I mean, in fact, I don't think that is the solution, but I think that's what people are afraid of.
You now line this up squarely with the Armenian genocide, the Holocaust, the Khmer Rouge genocide in Cambodia, with Rwanda. Is there any doubt in your mind that history will see this in those same terms, or is this muddier?
I don't think there's going to be any doubt about that. In fact, this is really a clearer case of genocide than, for example, the Cambodian case, where victims were selected not based on ethnicity but on education more than anything else. And you know, that's a little more ambiguous in terms of genocide. This is not. I mean, you have members being, you know, of the Zagawa tribe, of the Masalit, the Fura tribe, the Dajo tribe, being taken out and shot, raped as a government policy.
Nick, we're going to look in more detail at the politics holding up something here and the mindset holding up an intervention here, but bring us up to date on what's happening. You've been along the Chad border. You say it's spilling over. Remind us of what sparked this in the first place in Sudan, in Darfur, and why is it now spreading into Chad?
Well, there's been historic tension in Darfur between Arab tribes and non-Arab tribes, and they've been competing for water, for forage, and they're just, you know, normal tribal tensions. But then increasingly there were attacks on the non-Arabs, and then they started an incipient rebellion in 2003. And at that point, the Sudanese government just decided the simplest way to solve this headache, this rebellion, was to start slaughtering people en masse and to completely depopulate the rural parts of Darfur. And they've done that, you know, quite successfully for the last few years. And now they've decided the next way to extend the campaign is to drive people away from the Chad border and to topple the government of Chad. And so we're seeing the genocide now expanded.
And the humanitarian relief efforts also at this point being disrupted. We're hearing very colorful, loud warnings saying we can't get to these people what they need to survive in the refugee camps at this point. Why not?
Well, in areas, there are two problems. One is a lack of money, and so there are some cutbacks because of a lack of resources. But the biggest problem is simply lack of security. In the places that I went on this trip, all along the Chad-Sudan border, there are vast areas where there's no aid organization. There are no diplomats going there. There's nobody there because it's too risky. In one of the areas, Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, is operating, but they're the only aid group operating anywhere along that vast area.
So where are we headed here? Is this like a forest fire that finally burns itself out while the world looks the other way? Does an end come to this, or does the fire spread and grow?
I mean, I think the tragedy is that I think there are, you know, there are potential solutions. I don't think it is fated that you're going to lose another few hundred thousand people in Darfur. But if I were guessing, I think I would tend to guess on the pessimistic side that there isn't going to be enough pressure brought to bear to really stop this, and that the result is that you're going to get, you know, 2 million people living in camps and displaced for, you know, for another 10 or 20 years to come.
Nick, you've devoted yourself to this so personally now, clearly just written your heart out to try and turn the world's attention, turn the world's emotion this way, get something to happen. It hasn't happened yet. You've jumped on the media, you've jumped on the government, and we're going to hear from both of those veins in this hour. Let's look at the media first. That's kind of an interesting story there. You challenged Bill O'Reilly to come with you, get off your duff, Bill, and come out and see what's going on after he called you a left-wing ideologue. Yes.
Yeah.
You raised money on a website. People pledged $700,000 or $800,000 to send Bill O'Reilly to Sudan to see it firsthand. He didn't go, but you got network attention. Ann Curry from NBC. And the networks have, at least on their evening news, have paid only minutes of attention to this in recent years. So
CBS Evening News. Yeah. I mean, CBS Evening News last year devoted 2 minutes to genocide in Darfur, while those three networks had averaged 28 minutes to coverage of the Michael Jackson trial.
So 2 minutes in 12 months. 2 minutes in a year.
2 minutes in 12 months. 2 minutes over the course of the year. And you know, it seems to me that the real way to bring about change is going to be to put this on the agenda. And one thing that we in the news media can do, but have historically failed to do, is to help put genocide on the agenda.
We're going to hear from Ann Curry of NBC later in the hour. We're going to hear before that from Jinda Fraser, Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the U.S. State Department, just back recently herself from North Africa. Nick, take us in here to the geopolitics of this. Who's pushing what? Who's doing nothing? What's going on with the African Union and the UN? We read just last week that the African Union, which now has 7,000 troops on the ground, not really peacekeeping, they're supposed to be keeping a ceasefire that's not really going on, is pushing back against the UN, getting involved. Paint the picture for us of the big players. Who's doing what? Who's doing nothing? Why?
Sure. Well, the African Union, I mean, to its credit, did try to send troops there. They have 7,000 people there. Only 5,000 of them are armed. This is a vast area. Now, where they have been able to send troops, it has made a real difference. But they don't have nearly enough people. They, you know, you go there and they don't have any interpreters, so they don't have anybody who can speak to local people. Their radios aren't working. They don't have vehicles to go around. They don't have the resources, and it was a valiant effort, but it failed. And the African Union has also wimped out, I'm afraid, in that they deferred to Sudanese objections and did not immediately push for passing this protection force over to the UN. Europe has been a tremendous failure. It's been largely inert. Northern Europe has been pretty good about giving aid, giving Band-Aids, but Europe has been helpless in terms of actually trying to stop this. The Arab world and the Muslim world who have real influence over Sudan, they have completely missed the boat. And I think part of that is an outgrowth of Iraq. I think that we lost so much credibility in Iraq that there's this instinctive suspicion of anything we do. But it would make so much difference if Egypt were to take an interest in this, and they haven't. As for the U.S., you know, there have been moments when I'd say the U.S. has tended to do better than most of the rest of the world. But there have been moments when we have become more active, and when President Bush and Colin Powell, for example, termed it genocide. And then when we do that, you in fact see the level of killing subside, and Sudan does respond. And I think that's one of the things that I find just most heartbreaking about it, is that, you know, when the president and Congress simply pay a little more attention to it, it makes a real difference on the ground. And yet then, you know, for example, after the 2004 election, then everybody got distracted. When the tsunami happened, everybody looked the other way. Mm. And then the level of killings just increases.
But, Nick, let me ask you. There are reports lately that the State Department, that the United States is backing off the genocide label. In your view, is it still genocide going on in Darfur and now spilling over into Chad?
Absolutely. I mean, there has been a slowdown in some sense in that there are not a lot of villages left in Darfur to destroy. You drive through Darfur, and mile after mile after mile, you just pass one burned village after another. For example, now in Chad, I talked to people in village after village who described attacks by the Janjaweed, who were saying things about black people can't live in this land, black people have to leave. That black women deserve to be raped, that blacks are our slaves. I saw a boy who I think was 6 years old who'd been shot. There's no doubt in my mind that the genocide is absolutely continuing, and it's I think taking a sort of ominous and perilous route when it's being expanded into a new country across an international border.
We've got 20 seconds before the break. Why do you think the U.S. is backing off the G word, genocide?
I'm not sure that it has. I mean, there have been Gentye Fraser at one point seemed to be backing away in a press conference, but I don't – and periodically in the past, there have been similar moments. But I'm not sure that the administration as a whole is backing off.
Nick Kristof, I want to share with our listeners a bit of the sound of Darfur or here across the border in Chad that you brought back. Here's a moment where you're talking with a young man, Idris Ismail, in the village of Danri near Kloy in Chad. He's explaining how the Janjaweed, the Arab militia, surrounded his village, shot at their residence. He goes on to explain how he was forced to flee. Let's listen to a bit. Nick Kristof, you recorded this. Paint the picture of where you got it, and what exactly was Idris telling you?
This is a area near the town of Kloy, where the Janjaweed have been increasingly attacking these unarmed villages. And, these are mud brick, thatched roof villages with no defenses. And all of a sudden you'll get, in this case, the people who attacked, there were 500 of them on camels, on pickup trucks. The pickup trucks have heavy machine guns mounted on the back.
500 attackers 500, suddenly on a little village?
500.
Wow.
And they surround a village. And they most often do it at dawn, but at times other times of the day. And then they just start opening fire. There is a particular effort to kill men and boys. And even baby boys. I talked to one father who the Janjaweed had grabbed his baby from his wife, and it was just a baby, I think 6 months, and they checked and saw it was a boy, then threw it on the ground and shot it because it was a boy. So they surround these villages. They really make a strong effort to kill the males. The women, they try less hard to absolutely kill every last female, but they do make – there's a very conscious effort to go out and rape to kidnap and rape the women. They often mutilate them afterward to leave them marked and stigmatized forever as rape victims.
And there's the voice and there's the picture straight from the front.
Let me just add that Idris, that man you just heard, Idris, he was just beside himself because his wife, who was 7 or 8 months pregnant, was left behind, and I think he had four children, small children who'd been left behind as well, and they were in the village. And they were, he didn't know obviously exactly what was happening to them, but he said that, in his heart, he thought that you know, all the that everybody there was going to be killed. The women would be raped and the men just killed, but everybody would end up dead. And, you know, how do you try to reassure somebody like that?
Clearly, when you're one guy standing with a tape recorder, you do not. Nick Kristof, stand by. There it is. It's heartbreaking. It's happening right now. It has not been stopped. I want to welcome onto the program for a moment here from Washington, Jendai Fraser, Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department. She was U.S. Ambassador to South Africa. She's just very recently back from North Africa and Libya. Jendai Fraser, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
What's going on here? Is it still genocide? You're being quoted saying indirectly that it's not.
I'm not sure who's quoting me indirectly as saying that, but certainly the administration, President Bush, Secretary Rice, have very clearly stated that genocide has occurred in Darfur, in Sudan, and that the United States very much deplores the continued violence and attacks against innocent lives, innocent people, and that we need to work, the United States and the international community, rapidly to try to end this abuse and this violence, this organized violence, and that we have been working with the African Union. We've provided them with airlift into the region. We've created base camps. We've provided over $190 million to try to increase their capacity, and now we're pushing very hard to get that African Union force rehatted to make it a UN force, and that we, the United States and others, can continue to support a strong presence, security presence, military presence in the region to stop the type of violence that you just heard, as well as to push the parties in Nigeria, in Abuja, to come up with a peace agreement for a total peace to end this violence over the long term.
I want to hear
so,
about...
Yes, indeed, we see that a genocide has occurred in Darfur. The president is on record as saying that, and we're certainly committed to trying to end this type of unacceptable violence.
I want to look at exactly how that might happen, but I also want to look very closely here. Your wording has been consistent recently. You always say a genocide has occurred. Why do you not use the present tense? Nick Kristof says it's going on now. You're quoted.
A genocide is continuing to occur. A genocide has occurred. Whatever you label it, you can call it genocide. Whatever you mass violence, whatever you label it, innocent people are suffering and dying in Darfur. It's an unacceptable situation, and the United States and others in the international community, as well as in Africa, must do all that we can to stop it from happening.
Just for complete clarity, is there genocide going on now? Just let me ask you straight.
You said call it whatever you will,
but what do you call it? Does the State Department call it genocide now or not?
I just said that a genocide has occurred, a genocide is occurring, a genocide, whatever you label it. And that was my point in the past, which is however you label this, it's unacceptable killing of innocent people.
Why hasn't it been stopped? What's standing in the way?
The international community needs to do all that we can to try to end it. That my point is that call it genocide, call it whatever you want. The point is that people are dying and suffering. The United States stands alone in having called this a genocide. And so to get into a debate with other African countries and countries in the international community about whether this is genocide or not is a distraction. What we need to do is focus on the fact that innocent people are dying every day, and we need to do all that we can to stop the killing.
That
was my point.
We hear you. That killing has gone on for quite a while now, and the numbers continue to mount. Now we hear it spreading into Chad. You're very highly placed. What is your interpretation of why the global community has failed to stop it? Why hasn't it been stopped?
As I said, we are working very hard to stop this.
But it hasn't been stopped. Why hasn't it been stopped? Why is it still going on?
The main reason the fighting is occurring in Sudan is because the government of Sudan has unleashed the Janjaweed militia against innocent people. They've now lost control of that Janjaweed because the government of Chad has supported rebels in Sudan. The Sudanese government has supported rebels in Chad. And so you have a cross-border conflict of two national governments supporting rebels in each other's countries who also unleash violence against innocent people.
And why haven't the United States and the world been able to stop it?
Do you want me to answer your question? You also have
my question is why it hasn't been stopped. Why hasn't the power of the world been able to be brought together in such a way to stop it? You share the reasons with us, and I appreciate this.
The United States has been working very hard over the last month to get the African Union to make the request to the United Nations, which will not go into the country without we've worked very closely with Kofi Annan and the UNDPKO, the United Nations Department of Peacekeeping Operations, to say that we need to put a stronger, more credible force on the ground in Darfur. The African Union did not agree to have the UN do that rehatting until March 10th. We worked very hard to get them to make that request. The United Nations refused to go in until they had the request of the African Union. It's a diplomatic process that is also part of this. And so we've now at a point where we need to get a UN Security Council resolution with a Chapter 7 mandate, a robust mandate, so that we can use the type, give forces the type of capacity and mandate so that they can protect those innocent lives. But countries don't normally just show up on the border of a country and go in. We've been mobilizing the United Nations so that we can indeed stop this violence. We've done it already by the African Union. The government of Sudan and other governments, the government of Egypt and Libya and others, have opposed the United Nations having a presence in Darfur. We finally have passed that hurdle.
But genocide
so
is such
a diplomatic process that we are also involved in.
We understand that and how difficult that must be. At the same time, we, like you, see the killing that's gone on there. Was there a more direct, potent way for the international community to stop this, or was there never such a lever to pull?
Well, there was. When the violence was on a large scale, you had air cover from the government of Sudan attacking the Janjaweed. There was an effort by the region, as well as with the backing of the United States and donor countries, to get a ceasefire and to get African Union forces in place to stop the large-scale organized violence. That worked for a while. To halt the violence, the ceasefire held for a little bit, but that ceasefire is now broken down. The violence has started at a high level again, particularly as the Chad-Sudan conflict has exacerbated the violence, and so we now need a new response. The African Union mission stopped the organized violence for some months in time, but now we need a new response, and we believe that if we can get the United Nations peacekeeping operation under a robust Chapter 7 mandate, that we will be able to do that. But we have countries that are opposed to that, including the government of Sudan. We can understand that because they are belligerent in this conflict. They are responsible for the crisis taking place in Darfur. But if they don't accept the UN's presence, we're internationally going to invade this country. That's essentially the way it's being framed. And that's convincing to some countries. That's convincing to some members of the United Nations. So we have to get a common understanding. And we, the United States, are certainly in the lead in trying to mobilize other countries to get the United Nations in there. And we are prepared to work through the NATO, through the United Nations, through whatever mechanism, multilateral forum that we can, to get forces in place as quickly as possible to stop this violence, because it is an unacceptable situation.
Jendaya Fraser, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, just back last week from North Africa. Secretary Fraser, thank you very much for being with us.
Most certainly. Thank you.
Nick Kristof, you hear it. The deal to bring on Jendaya Fraser was that she would be on alone, but you hear her. She says, it's still genocide. That sounds new to me. And she says, we are internationally going to invade this country. How do you interpret the policy, the plans that you're hearing laid out right there, Nick?
I was glad that she said that that she does regard it as genocide that is continuing, because I think that's exactly right. I think that what she says is exactly right, that there is indeed a diplomatic process, and the U.S. has been doing the things she said. It has been putting pressure on the African Union to bring in the U.N. It has been working with European allies. It has been working on rehatting. But I think the problem I have is that it all seems kind of small bore. And, that's not a complaint about Jendaya Fraser's work. It's fundamentally a question for the country as a whole. Now, during the Rwandan genocide, we had the National Security Council and officials in the government were meeting, and they had endless discussions about, for example, jamming extremist Hutu radio broadcast and how to do that.
Right.
And, you know, well, maybe that would have been a nice idea, but it just wasn't. It wasn't enough. It wasn't a useful response. And we're kind of at the same level of detail now. We're, in effect, talking about jamming Sudan. What we need to talk about is how to put this squarely on the international agenda and achieve a peace process that is going to work. The existing peace process is broken, is going to get nowhere. So we have to focus at a much higher level on the combination of a new peace initiative and a much stronger security force.
Nick Kristof, let me bring our listeners in. Jonas is calling from Boston. Hi, Jonas. You're on the air.
How are you doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Jonas? What do you know?
Well, a couple of situations that what Nick is bringing out. I'm very familiar with Nick writing. He wrote a couple of articles about North Africa, about Eritrea, et cetera, et cetera. What Dr. Fraser is saying, it's completely wrong. First of all, the United States is not doing much about the Darfur situation. Actually, they're hindering the process. First of all, we have to look at it in a climate that is, one, the oil, how much oil is involved in the Sudan area and the Chinese movement in there. United States is much concerned about that. If this was another part of the country that's happening, genocide, United Nations, United States will come occur with force. That happened in Yugoslavia. But this is repeating as a Rwanda situation where millions of people are dying because it's in Africa.
Jonas, you just heard Jendai Fraser say, we are internationally going to invade this country. That sounds like moving in.
You know, that sounds like a political lip, actually, because actually they're hindering it more than ever. It's a very sad situation because I have friends who fled and they came here through missionaries who brought them a bunch of church. They're sad stories. It's so sad. It's just incredible that at this age, this is happening.
It is.
And other powerful countries are turning their head around that says, ignoring, oh, nothing's happening in Sudan. Because Sudan is, the government of Sudan, al-Bashir, all of them are very belligerent, madness people. Who, one, they don't care about others.
And we see the outcome of that every day, Jonas. Our time is short. I want to thank you for your call. Nick Kristof, what about oil and China? Is that a big sort of under-the-covers bump in the road here?
It's a bump in the road. I mean, I don't think that that is a central U.S. motivation, but it's true that 65% of Sudan's oil does indeed go to China. China has been increasingly concerned about its own energy security. And there, it has, in effect, done a deal whereby it gets Sudan's oil and, in turn, it protects Sudan in the UN Security Council. In effect, this is the second genocide that China has underwritten after the Khmer Rouge one initially in the 1970s.
So has the United States bowed to China on this? Jonas is saying the U.S. is not doing all that it can and wants to know why.
Oh, we're certainly not doing all we can, but we are doing, you know, more than we have – more than other countries are doing and more than we've – traditionally done in other genocides. I must say, I mean, it's a little hard to judge the administration because of that. Initially, I think I was a little more sympathetic because Bush has done, for example, so much more than Clinton ever did in Rwanda. Mm. On the other hand, you know, Rwanda only lasted 3 months, and this has been going on now, you know, depending on how you count, for you know, getting toward 3 years.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Darfur Sudan killing getting worse and now spilling across the border into Chad with Nick Kristof of the New York Times, just back from his sixth trip to the region. He has written very, very persuasively, urgently about it, yet the killing goes on. Nick Kristof challenged Fox News' Bill O'Reilly to come along with him and see what's going on there firsthand. Bill O'Reilly took a pass, but Ann Curry, NBC News anchor with The Today Show and Dateline, didn't take a pass. She went along, traveled with Nick Kristof to Chad, traveled down the border between Sudan and Chad, seeing herself for the first time how violence is spreading between the two countries. Let's listen to her report.
We're now crossing the border from Darfur, Sudan, into Chad. And take a look at this. There are no markers, no one to stop you. You can see how easy it is for the violence in Darfur to bleed across the border into Chad. And this border is 400 miles long.
Ann Curry of NBC News joins me now from New York. Ann, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, it's a pleasure.
We value your fresh eyes on this. I mean, Nick Kristof never gets I was going to say never gets tired of reporting it. I'm sure he does, but he never loses the urgency. You're seeing it for the very first time. Give us a sense of what that was like, Ann.
Well, it's a dramatic story, and Nick has been a saint in his coverage, I think, about this story. I think that there are a lot of people within our operation who've been wishing that and been embarrassed that we have not, as news organizations, responded to the story sooner. It was a great privilege, actually, to travel with Nick to this story. You know, you're everywhere you look, under every tree, every place you go, you hear pretty much remarkably this very similar stories, and they're gripping stories about people who are talking, describing being attacked by they describe Arab militias, mm-hmm. people on horseback, on camels, firing guns. You know, and the worst part of this, the part that really grips you, is the looks on their faces as they describe having been called black slaves, having been told that if they don't leave, they will be slaughtered, describing having people in their families being wounded or having been killed or now being missing. It's a heartbreaking story, and remarkably, it's not hard to find in this region.
Nick Kristof, Bill O'Reilly took a pass, but Ann Curry was right there next to you. I noticed.
Hey, Ann was a much Ann was a much better traveling partner than Bill O'Reilly would have been.
I guess he wasn't one at all. You say in your columns this time, Nick, that you yourself were pretty uncomfortable in some of these situations, as in afraid.
Yeah. Oh, I'm scared all the time when I'm in Darfur or that area. It is a scary, and there's probably one reason why we in the media have tended to have blown this story. It has to be covered. You can't have a mass genocide going on in the 21st century and just ignore it.
Ann Curry, how does it work as television? I hate to put it in those terms, but you know, images get to people's hearts, pull their heartstrings, make policy change visually. We've seen your reports coming out, but what's your assessment as a TV pro? If there were enough TV coverage in this area, might it change world policy?
It absolutely would. There's no question in my mind. Let me tell you, I have gotten only enormous response from viewers and through emails and phone calls. The phone really has been ringing off the hook. But really, I've also gotten an interesting response from U.S. officials and from officials at the United Nations. I think that the images have been so gripping, and in part, yes, we have had a very talented crew along with us. But the truth is, the pictures are there, and that's why they're so gripping. And we let me just tell you, on nightly news on Monday night,
yeah.
The people inside the control room were absolutely silent. They said you could hear a pin drop because they could not believe what they were seeing. These kinds of images have affected America already, and I think if we can continue to get this stuff on television, I think it will make people realize this is intolerable.
Katie Couric said right on air on the Today Show to you that you've had to put a lot of pressure on executives at NBC to send you. I'm sure that made you very popular. Why their reluctance? Why not more? Why 2 minutes on CBS last year? I don't know what NBC's number was, but these are small numbers. Why?
Well, you know, I don't know that I can fully explain why. I do know that it's very difficult and expensive and challenging because of the physical danger as a news organization to send crews to send a team into a place like Darfur or on the edge of Darfur in Chad. I don't think that there is a good excuse for this inaction. I think Nick has been absolutely right to hammer us and all news media for not having done more on this story. But listen, I've been for 2 years, actually a little more than 2 years, been struggling to convince NBC to send us there. And NBC was, after about 6 months, willing to send me. But the other part of the problem really has to be directed at Khartoum. Look, Sudan does not give you visas. Once I got the approval from NBC, Sudan was not granting visas. And I doubt that they're granting visas today. It's very difficult now today for a journalist from the United States to get into Darfur legally. And the only reason I got in there, even for the short time that I was in there on this past trip, was illegally. I mean, to be honest with you, I crossed the border without permission, without a visa.
Yep.
And that's the dilemma.
You're back with the tape, and we congratulate you on that. Is this one going to haunt you, Ann?
Haunt me. It's you know what? This is a story that will not let you go. I understand, and I admire Nick for continuing to put himself in harm's way to get to give voice to these voiceless people. I mean, these are people who were poor to begin with. and they've been now put on the run, and now they're not even given the decency of others to allow them to survive. And I've actually already started discussions here and trying to find ways to get back in to do the story, to continue doing the story. And I'm encouraging NBC, and I'm encouraging actually our competitors to you know, pick up this story and run with it. Look, this, I think that this, I just did an interview yesterday with Jan Englund about this, and I actually have more stories planned on Nightly on Thursday night, and I have convinced Dateline will run something. It's planning to run something this coming Sunday night. And so I'm not letting this thing go, because it cannot, it's not letting me go.
What's your word to Bill O'Reilly, Ann? Should he go with Nick next time?
I think if Nick can tolerate Bill O'Reilly, then Bill O'Reilly should definitely go with Nick, because you know what? The story will be right at his feet. He won't have to, certainly he'll have to live in a struggle and be in a not easy environment to cover the story, but it won't be hard to find.
Sounds like a good traveling companion there, Nick. Ann Curry, thank you so much for being with us.
I'll go anywhere with Nick.
Ann Curry, NBC News anchor. She's been reporting all week on the Darfur and the spillover into Chad for NBC. Just back from a trip there with Nick Kristof of The New York Times. Let's turn to our listeners. Jack is calling from Moline, Illinois. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First thing I'd like to mention is I heard on NPR this morning a little news report about the Iran nuclear situation, and a reference to China. China told Iran, it was reported in today's news, that, you know, don't count on our vote in the UN, because, you know, we're not going to vote like the way you want us.
So where are you going there? You're saying China can be a good actor?
I'm saying that we should not jump to conclusions about China's motivations for oil market in the Darfur situation. We should not jump to conclusions.
I don't know if it's jumping to conclusions. It seems that they've leaned against intervention so far. But how do you see what's unfolding there now, Jack? What should the U.S. do?
Well, because China is leaning against it because the United States is unique. You know, China is not the United States. China does not have the history that the United States does. I mean, this situation in Darfur in the Sudan is the greatest manifestation of the moral corruption of the Bush administration.
Well, let us pick that up, Jack, because Nick Kristof has been complimentary of the administration. And Jack, stand by. Nick, you've really gone both ways on this. Been very harshly critical, but also very glowingly praising of the Bush administration. Where's the moral compass needle stand?
Well, I mean, the President Bush has failed dramatically in that there are 300,000 people who are dead who, you know, needn't be dead. On the other hand, if he had acted as Clinton had done in Rwanda, then there would be probably a couple hundred thousand more who were dead. And I think we absolutely need to hold President Bush's feet to the fire. There are so many more things he could do. You know, just a speech on Darfur would cost him nothing but would help get it much more attention. On the other hand, the same is true of President Clinton, for example. Clinton has been quiet on Darfur. He has credibility in Europe and in the Arab world. You know, why doesn't he speak out as well? I mean, so I think
you mean even now when he's no longer
even
president?
Now,
raise
absolutely,
the noise.
Absolutely, even now that, you know, that if he spoke out, that would also make a difference. I'm afraid that the moral failure we have is utterly bipartisan.
Utterly bipartisan. You quote President Bush from his second inaugural address, "All who live in tyranny and hopelessness can know the United States will not ignore your oppression or excuse your oppressors." You write, Mr. Bush, so far that has been a ringing falsehood, and yet you say it's a bipartisan failure here, and we hear that. Roman's calling from Rockville, Maryland. Roman, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I'd like to commend all three of you for giving voice to this issue, very important issue. My question has to do with trying to explain why public opinion in the U.S. and the media has focused so little attention. And I think the problem is we really don't know, or we haven't discussed what would be the end game in Darfur, beyond the ceasefire, beyond stopping the immediate violence. Where are we going to see? Are we going to see Darfur part of the Federated Sudan? Are we going to need to see a regime change in Sudan, in Khartoum? Because let's say if we don't have a regime change or a behavioral change at least, are we going to be talking about the problems in the east of Sudan? Or are we going to be talking about the problems again of the south of Sudan in 6 years' time when the agreement becomes due? Also, we need to, I think, as a whole, address the policy of U.S. toward Africa in a sense of tolerating, if not outright supporting, authoritarian regimes going on in Khartoum, existing in Chad, throughout northern Africa, Sahelian Africa.
Yeah, it's a big picture you're painting, Roman, but let us pick it up. Nick Kristof, first to the end game. You and others are saying, let's get more force in there. Fareed Zakaria this week in Newsweek is quoting a Sudanese activist, Mudawi Ibrahim Adam, saying military intervention, troops, not much of a solution.
Well, there are two things that we need. I mean, it's true that sending troops there isn't a solution. I mean, it saves lives, but you also need a political solution. And the existing political process in Abuja between the government and the rebels has failed.
This is the long-distance talks that are supposed to be going on in Abuja, Nigeria.
In Abuja, Nigeria. And and they have gotten nowhere. It seems to me that they're never going to get anywhere. And we need to start a new process. The best way to do that would be with the sheikhs of the region. They have a traditional conciliation mechanism that has not been used.
The sheikhs, now, will the sheikhs be on the, in the Janjaweed corner or
in
the refugees corner,
corners.
Or both?
In both corners. There are sheikhs in the African tribes and in the non-African tribes. And at this point, you know, it would have been impossible to achieve a peace like this a couple of years ago, even a year ago. But at this point, even the sheikhs in the Janjaweed corner in the, of those Arab tribes, they have now – they're beginning to suffer tremendously as well. And the reason is that even though they've – you know, stolen vast numbers of livestock, for example, their migration routes have been disrupted, and they've discovered that when they slaughter everybody, then they have no market towns in which they can buy goods. So they are now, I think, increasingly ready to go back to the something closer to the status quo ante.
So the land you burn may be your own, but what does the end game look like here? If it's a local solution, does that have to mean autonomy for Darfur? That seems to be what they wanted in the first place. Will it take regime change in Khartoum to pry that out of Sudan?
A regime change would be great, but I don't think we can count on it. The Darfur problem is actually much easier to solve than the North-South Sudan problem was because they're Southern Sudan wanted independence. The people of Darfur, they don't. They want more autonomy. They want more national resources. And, you know, now they want to be able to go back to their villages to have some security. Wells have been poisoned. They want to have that ended and so on. But the kinds of things that the rebels in Darfur and that the African tribes in Darfur are asking for are entirely soluble within the structure of Sudan. And so that is one reason why this is not, you know, some terrible insoluble problem that has to go on forever. But, you know, if we really push, we can address it.
Within the structure of Sudan is pretty broad language. Does that mean with the current government it could still be solved, or are they just never going to? They haven't been forced to yet.
No, it could be resolved. I mean, if you could – the North-South agreement ended the North-South Civil War that went on, you know, for 20 years. I mean, that really seemed to be pretty close to insoluble. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was solved. The Darfur problems, if Khartoum is willing to give greater autonomy, to allocate greater resources to Darfur, then those problems can be resolved. And the key is to have the negotiations not be between Khartoum and the rebels, both of which are, you know, pretty thuggish, recalcitrant parties, but to freeze them out and to involve the sheikhs in the area.
But how do you do that? Does that mean putting a cordon of blue helmets around this area, that huge area the size of France, for the next 20 years? I mean, how do you really freeze out the militia who are there? You described the 500 with their camels and their big guns, the government in Khartoum. How do you freeze them out?
Sure. I mean, a couple of things. There are discussions among people about, you know, about the mechanisms of this. But essentially, it would involve Kofi Annan appointing somebody like Colin Powell to be a special envoy. And Powell has not closed the door on this option. He's skeptical, but he hasn't closed the door on it. Kofi Annan hasn't closed the door on it. Dr. Mudawi, who you mentioned, Fareed Zakaria had quoted, he would perhaps be Powell's chief of staff for this effort. Sudan would not like it, but if enough pressure were brought, Sudan would accept it. The leading Arab tribe in the region, the Rizigat Arabs, they strongly support this approach. They have not engaged in the genocide. In fact, they've sheltered the African tribes. They would be a key player. And then you would simultaneously with this political process, you would bring in, you would rehat the African Union forces, so it would be part of a larger UN force. You would have perhaps Turkish troops to go into, you know, Muslim troops with airlift capacity from the U.S., but no U.S. ground troops. And so ultimately, if you had a much more mobile, much better equipped UN force to start attacking the Janjaweed, supplemented by a no-fly zone to keep the Sudanese military planes grounded, those would be the components of something that, would it work? I mean, there are no guarantees, but what we are trying right now is failing, and this alternative approach my guess is that there's a 50% chance or 70% chance that it would work.
Failing right now, and it's spreading, as you write. I'm looking at a wire story straight off the wire saying Chad government forces have quashed an attempted military coup. Could this spread, or is this a local thing, Nick?
I think that's the best example of not only the moral bankruptcy of our policy, but the practical bankruptcy of it too, that after 3 years of this, that now it's spread into Chad. And there's a real prospect of a Sudanese invasion of Chad that could unleash a new civil war in Chad and make, expand Darfur manyfold.
Nick Kristof, you keep us on our toes. We're grateful to you for your trips and your reporting. Thanks very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure. Thanks for, keeping a light focused on this issue.
Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.